first thing I wanted to say is just express a very, very deep gratitude to Bhante, first and foremost. Without his efforts, none of us would be here. And also to my preceptors, Viveka, my private preceptor, and Dayanandi, who's up the mountain right now, my public preceptor. And also my Kalyana Mitras, Pamadarini, and Viveka. And I wanted to dedicate this talk to Viveka and Pamadarini. So may our friendships with one another continue to inspire and guide us towards the attainment of enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Just having a feng shui moment. I don't want to be looking down too much. So in this talk, I'm going to try and do three things. The first is just speak quite personally about my own experience of spiritual friendship. Actually, my very first experience of spiritual friendship with Viveka. And then I'll say a few things, just what I've been reflecting on. So what's come up for me. This has been a theme for me for quite a long time. In a way, a bit despite myself. And it just keeps rolling on. The reflections keep unfolding. So this talk is very much just a moment in time in terms of where I'm at with my own reflections around the theme of spiritual friendship and the Sangraha Vastus. And then I'll just say a little bit more specifically about the Sangraha Vastus. So what is it within them? How can we work with them? And specifically, what are their... Well, in a way, where's the ground? Where's the sort of working ground within them? But then also, what's the aspects of the Sangraha Vastus that help to align us more with the way things really are, with reality? So the insight aspects of these practices. So I'm sure we've all had this experience, when we see someone who's kind of further along the path than we are. It's a bit of a mystery how we know that. But somehow, something that they're doing resonates with something deep inside of us. So it could be a way that they communicate, or their intelligence, or just their presence, really. Just something. There's just something about them. And although we may not be conscious of it at the time, and this is especially true for me early on, what we're seeing is the ways in which they actually are more aligned with reality. So their being is much more aligned with the way things really are. And we long to be intimate with that reality, and therefore we long to be intimate with that person. So we move towards them out of this longing for harmony. And then, hopefully, they respond to us and move towards us. So there's a dynamic. And they move towards us out of a deep desire to help us to awaken to the truth. So for me, this person was Viveka. I was probably about 22. My mom had died of breast cancer about 6 years before I walked through the doors of the San Francisco Buddhist Center. And I was a young, angry little baby dyke, basically. And I think I wore like baggy shorts and had a shaved head and combat boots and lots of piercings, that kind of thing. And I think I spent the first 2 years just sort of sitting in the little sitting area in the Buddhist Center, just watching people with probably a scowl on my face. And I think, you know, I look back at journals from that time, and I just desperately wanted to be loved, and I wanted to love. I wanted to really be able to love. And I also had deeply held views that I was unlovable and not able to love. So there was this tension. And I also struggled with very negative mental states. So I had quite a lot of cynicism going on, as well as lots of jealousy and anger. I've had a few friendships quite recently before coming to the Buddhist Center that had fallen apart because of these mental states, because of this way I was being. And I was just really sick of it. I was sick of myself. I was sick of the way I was relating to the world and other people, and I just knew I needed, something needed to happen. So I think I had picked up a few meditation books, and one of them said, everything in this book is great, and at some point you will need a teacher and you will need a sangha. And so I think I did a Google search, and I found the Buddha Center. And I remember when I first learned the Metta Bhavna, like so many of us, I really struggled with the first stage, which is not surprising. And I remember telling Viveka after class about it in quite a dramatic way. And I think I was expecting her to collude with me, like, oh, that's terrible. You know, what can we do about that? And I think she sort of said, she kind of looked at me in this way that she kind of looks at you without sort of any, you kind of feel like there's maybe nothing going on. And then she sort of said, well, that's interesting. And she sort of just kind of smiled. And I was really unsatisfied with that. It was just, I'd never experienced that before. And also, I was incredibly drawn to her equanimity. I thought, oh, there's something else. There's another way to be with what's happening. It doesn't have to be a drama. And I remember staying after class, and I'm actually really surprised about this now, knowing Viveka as well as I do. She's an incredibly busy woman, and she's got a lot of friends. But she would hang out for hours with me after class, just talking about the Dharma and getting to know each other. And I just feel really, really grateful for that, actually. I feel really grateful that she saw something in me and that she made that effort, even though she probably didn't have the time or the energy. So I'm really grateful for how well she was able to meet me in all of my sort of messiness, and how sincere her interest in me was. And there was a part of me that knew it wasn't about her. Being friends wasn't about her, it wasn't about me, but it was about something we were doing together. It was about a path we were on together. And I knew she was really interested in supporting me in that. And that was very, very important. I knew she was very interested in helping me to create the conditions to liberate myself from my suffering. And 10 years later, she ordained me, so whatever she was doing, it worked. It worked for me. And I know it works for other people as well. So those of you who were here yesterday, we did a reflection on the preciousness of spiritual friendship. And I'll just say a little bit about that. Maybe we can just take a minute to connect back with whatever was happening for us during that reflection. So when I was preparing for this talk, I was on retreat and I was doing a lot of thinking. And at some point I just decided I just wanted to drop into my heart and just see what was there. And I did just touch into this preciousness. And all my friends started coming to mind. And then eventually the whole order, this whole mandala came to mind. And I did just feel, in a way I don't think I've touched into before, just how incredibly precious it is. And I did think, oh, it's so lucky we found each other, actually. It's so lucky we're all here. And then I thought, actually, it's not luck. It's karma vipaka. So we've gotten here as a result of our efforts. So just to touch into that and really acknowledge that, I think is quite important. Not just our own, but our friends as well, the efforts they've made. And isn't it so lovely? Here we are. It's come to fruition. We're getting there together. So when Tara Vandana introduced the weekend, she said that she thinks that maybe, she sort of posed it as a question, maybe Kalyanamitrata is expressed through the Sangha of Vastus. So I'll be exploring that a bit. So I do think that the Sangha of Vastus, generosity, kindly speech, beneficial activity, and exemplification do actually define what a spiritual friend looks like, a good spiritual friend looks like. So you could even go so far as to say that if spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life, and the Sangha of Vastus make up the whole of spiritual friendship, then The Sangraha Vastus are the whole of the spiritual life. And they are also, they have, as I said before, these two elements. So they have both the practice component, the bhavna, so it's what we're doing, and also they represent an ideal. So they represent what the natural behavior of an awake being would look like. So they're both the path and the goal, in a way. And in Bhante's talk, The Meaning of Friendship in Buddhism, he talks about the five duties to our friends, which are pretty much synonymous with the Sangraha Vastus. And then there's also keeping our promises, which I think is quite sweet, the fifth duty to our friend. So he says, these five duties constitute a communication of the Dharma. You communicate the Dharma itself by practicing friendship in this way. You could even go so far as to say friendship is the Dharma. In fact, if you're practicing friendliness, you're not only practicing the Dharma, you're spreading the Dharma. So I find that actually quite affirming. All we have to do is be friendly in this way. That's all we have to do. There's nothing more. It's a complete picture. So I'm just going to talk a bit about what we're really doing. Why are we really practicing spiritual friendship? And I'd like to just suggest that we're practicing spiritual friendship ultimately to develop insight into the true nature of reality and to integrate that insight into our being. So that over the course of our spiritual lives, we think, speak, and act more and more in accordance with reality and the way things really are. So it's not friendship just for the purpose of friendship. It's towards this common goal that we all have. And I've been reflecting on what I've termed the koan of spiritual friendship. So I'll just say a little bit about what that is and go into it. So one of the translations of exemplification is treating others as we treat ourselves. So if we treat our friends as we treat ourselves, then that means that we also work on our relationship with them in the same way that we work on our relationship with ourselves. So you could say we work on our relationships with them in the same way we work with our own minds in meditation and outside of meditation. And we practice meeting our friends in the same way that we practice meeting ourselves in all our messiness and also in all our gloriousness. So Bhante in on Being All Things to All Men says, exemplification does not mean being the living embodiment of a particular point in the process of spiritual development, however high that point may be. It means being the embodiment of the principle of spiritual development itself, to however limited an extent. It means surely that we are at least making an effort to evolve. So I love that quote. And I find this idea of the principle of spiritual development itself quite mysterious. And for me, what that looks like is this koan. So I'll just unpack that a bit. So the koan is, how do we practice being with our own and one another's complete messiness in all its glorious process of unfolding, while simultaneously imagining one another as awakened beings? So how do we open more and more to the potential of awakening in ourselves and others, even in the worst of times? And when I was reflecting on this, I thought, oh, well, actually, that's just unconditional love. That's all that is. It's just being able to love one another in a way that's not conditioned by our behavior, but remain steady, because it's based on seeing past our faults. and sort of getting straight to the heart of things, getting to our own potential, each other's potential for awakening. So Subhuti says in Buddhism and Friendship, which is a really good book, if you haven't read it, I would highly recommend it. He says, from the Buddhist viewpoint, the good qualities of human beings are those that contain the seeds of their future enlightenment. Their virtues are threads that can connect them to reality, and in that sense, they are more real than their faults. Seeing human beings in this light, we can honestly acknowledge their weaknesses and our own, without lingering over them unnecessarily. Friendship is the ideal context in which to awaken this insight. So I love that, without lingering over them unnecessarily. It's a very English way of saying, get our knickers in a twist, which is also a very English way of saying, you know, get all worked up. You know, we don't need to get all worked up. So through spiritual friendship, we both help one another to work on transforming our unskillful habits and wrong views, and also awaken to the truth of what we ultimately are. So how does that actually work in friendship? So when we begin the spiritual journey, I'm sure we all know this, we figure out pretty quickly that we're not going to get very far without metta and mindfulness. And we have to learn to cultivate that non-judgmental, kindly awareness of what is arising in our experience. So in our practice of spiritual friendship, we also need to practice this kind of kindly, non-judgmental awareness towards each other. And what this means is that, you know, harsh judgments, so judgments in themselves can be helpful, but harsh judgments serve absolutely no purpose in the spiritual life. They have no place in what we're trying to do. They're not helpful, and they're not necessary towards ourselves or towards our friends. So in friendship, what we're doing is, instead of judging, for me anyways, the work has been opening more and more to my friends, and accepting at deeper and deeper levels all the ways in which they do not live up to my ideals. And then moving towards the pain of that, actually, hopefully in connection with the other person, if we can do that. While at the same time placing our heart on the truth of their potential, so keeping that in mind. And supporting each other to cultivate and familiarize ourselves with mental states that are more open, loving, and gracious. So I have a short story to just bring this out a bit. So I was recently on retreat, actually here at Taraloka. I was leading, it was the first time I was leading a week-long meditation retreat. And we were doing a lot of work around the Anapanasati Sutta and really looking at our minds. And then in a team meeting, one of my co-leaders, who's also a very, very good friend, just basically completely lost it on me. and it was just like a verbal attack, is the best way I can explain it. It was just, actually, it was really, really, really good for both of us. It was a really, really exceptional moment. Cause she was just being herself, whatever the conditions they had created, the perfect storm of her outburst. And because we'd been doing all these practices, I was also just sitting there, kind of totally receptive to what was happening, very aware of, you know, rushes of energy that could potentially have very easily solidified into anger and blame. And it was very apparent to me that, like, I didn't have to do that in that moment. So I had a choice in that moment about whether I was going to make it about her and about me and about our friendship, or if whether I was going to just kind of let her do what she was doing and try and hold it all in love. And although it was an incredibly painful experience, and I did have to let myself, you know, go through many days of feeling the pain of that experience, it was also incredibly liberating for both of us, because we were able to explore what was happening pretty much, you know, kind of in the moment, not in that very moment, but over the course of the next few days and couple of weeks. And that happened in March. And I can say that by the end of the month, really, beginning of April, it was completely gone. I have absolutely no hard feelings towards this person at all. So it was incredibly liberative. If you'd even told me sort of this is going to happen, I wouldn't have thought that I would have been able to kind of work through it as quickly as I was able to. So I think that obviously we were on retreat, so the conditions were quite good to be able to work through it. But there was also something else happening there for me about actually taking the opportunity of my friend being at her worst to be at my best. And so I think that's the gift we give each other, is we give each other the gift to be at our best when we're at our worst, or vice versa. So this gave rise to a question for me, which I'm exploring right now, so I'd like to pose it. So what if instead of seeing each other as challenges or problems that need to be solved, we saw each other as simply learners in a process? So we're all just learning. We're all just on this journey trying to figure it out. So when our friend is being difficult, for example, playing out their worst habits, acting from a narrow, self-centered perspective, wrapped up in prapancha, blaming others, what if we really understood in those moments that that is simply our friend in the process of doing what they do? It's not an issue that needs to be addressed or a problem that needs to be solved. They are conditioned in that moment. It's the conditions of their life have just brought them to that moment in time, and that's all that's happening. So what if we had enough insight to see the difference between what they're doing, its effect on us, and then what we do with that? So any sort of unnecessary stories we start to tell ourselves about them or about us or about the world. So Vivek always says, oh, that's just like the magical display of so-and-so. I just think that's such a beautiful way to think of people. And I'm happy to say that I think I've probably been using this language lately in my chapter, because yesterday Charnalka said, oh, that's just the magical display of me. It was great. So, yeah, it kind of brings a lightness to it. It's like, oh, can we just, like, be really, like, fascinated in that? Like, let's be fascinated in our process and, like, unpick it and look at it together. So it's quite a nice way to look at each other, like, unconditionally and also with curiosity, where we can be exactly as we are in all our ugliness and loveliness. My very good friend Pisadini, who's here this weekend, is very good at this. So I was rejoicing in her yesterday, and she seemed to not quite know what I was saying, so I had to spell it out for her. But basically, she's very good at when the shit hits the fan, as we say in America. She just goes right into like, oh, I'm really curious about what's going on for you right now. What's that about? And it's just beautiful. It's really lovely. A lovely way to, rather than reacting to each other, we could just kind of stop and say, wow, what's happening now? So from this place, we can drop all the anxiety about, oh, you know, like, what's the right thing to say, or what advice should I be giving, or how can I help my friend be different than how they are? And we can just help each other to wake up to what's happening right now. So just be fully present with their experience, connect with their deepest intentions, manifest their highest potential out of the experience rather than in spite of it. So there's a, in order to do this, in order to meet our friends in this way, we do have to get on with working on our own stuff and the development of insight in our own practice. So we all have a responsibility to each other and to our friends to work on our own integration, positivity, and transformation so that we can support one another to do the same. So when we're being lazy, we're not the only ones who suffer. So we need to work on our own development of insight. And the more that we do that, the more the natural response to suffering will be compassion. So the more we'll be able to actually meet our friends with compassion. And then that's really the starting point for authentic communication and connection to begin. Okay. So if we get to know each other well enough, we'll also get to know each other's habits well enough. If we build enough trust, we'll also be able to build enough robustness in our connection to take risks with one another and to help each other become more conscious of the ways that we continue to create suffering for ourselves and others. So friendship is about forging this intimate bond. So we do have to meet our friends where we were. And during the reflection yesterday, this came up. I can't remember if it was in my small group or in the large gathering at the end of the workshop. But there's something about, we do need to, as the stories about the Buddha go, you know, he met everyone where they were. We do also need to do that. We need to be deciphering in what different people need, different friends might need, and not be the same in every friendship. So our friendships with different people will have different qualities, different dynamics. And through our deepening connections, this work of kind of really getting interested in each other, showing real interest in our friends as spiritual beings, not just in relationship to us, we begin to loosen around our preferences and expectations of other people. And we allow them the space to then just become, really be their own person. Not just a projection of the person that we wished they were. And then in this way, we also begin to experience ourselves as less rigid, allowing our own preferences to fall away. Yeah, so we're just allowing each other space to change and to grow and develop into more wise and compassionate beings. So I really do want to kind of urge us to help each other wake up. Let's do that for each other. So let's think, speak, and act in ways that support connection rather than separation and liberation rather than suffering. So I'm just going to say a bit now about how the Sangharavastus help us to align with these, with different aspects of reality, and also talk about this sort of ground aspect of them as well. So the bhavana and then the insight elements. So I'll just say what those are, and then I'll go into a bit more depth. So for dana. I'm making this up. So this is just my own reflection. So you can come up with your own. This isn't like what the Buddha said or anything. This is just what's come out of my own stuff. So for dana, for me, what's been useful is, practicing gratitude. And the insight element, of generosity is seeing the truth of impermanence. For kindly speech, for me, it's about deep listening. That's sort of the starting place, the ground. And then the insight element is conditionality. For beneficial activity, the ground is receptivity. And the aspect that aligns us more with reality is seeing into the truth of unsatisfactoriness or suffering. And then finally, exemplification, the ground is confession. And what we awaken into is interconnectedness, non-separateness. So, generosity. So, I don't know about you, but sometimes it's hard to be generous. So, it's a great intention, and it can be difficult at times, depending on what's going on for us. So I try and cultivate gratitude. So I try and sort of reflect on what it is that I've received from my friends that has conditioned my own development. And from this place, then I more naturally want to give. So I, in a way, it's I'm trying to create conditions for a generous heart to emerge. And we'll naturally want to give not just back to our own friends, but to others as well, to potential friends, mitras around the center, potential mitras. So we'll want to continue that flow of unobstructed generosity that we have so benefited from. And then generosity helps to align us with the truth of impermanence. So, we don't really exist in the way we think we do. We are impermanent in every possible way. And so are all of our things. So if we're impermanent and all of our things are impermanent, how can we own those things? How can they belong to us? They can't. So when we reflect on this, it becomes a lot easier to just give things away, just let it go. So when we practice in this way, we're aligning ourselves with that truth of impermanence. We're actually exemplifying an alignment with that truth. So what do we give? What do we receive? How do we move towards creating friendships that are less transactional and more transformative? So it's not so much about, I did this for them, therefore they should do this for me. So that's a common thought that I have. Well, you know, I did that, so shouldn't they? So it's more about here we are together on this path, and we're giving what we can to support one another's liberation. So that's not going to be necessarily an equal give and take. So we stretch ourselves to give time, energy, food, space, possessions. And we also receive generously, so giving each other the opportunity to give. It was lovely before, so there was like an hour before, after breakfast and before now. And I thought, oh, I had this idea in my head. I'm going to have this hour. It's going to be really spacious. I'm going to look through my talk. I'm going to make, you know, little tweaks here and there. And then, you know, just people just were around. And I had to let it go because there was something else that was being asked of me. And I just thought, oh, that's it. It's just happening just right now. So, and then Vajramudita showed up with the most adorable, soft stuffed animal bunny. And it just dissolved everything. It was fantastic. So in the spirit of the giving of gifts, I'll read this wonderful quote from Bhante. By giving someone a present, you give expression to your special awareness of them. You give expression to your positive feeling towards them. You give expression to your genuine concern for them. Giving, in fact, is a form of communication. We could even formulate a general principle here, even formulate a sort of aphorism. We could say a spiritual community is characterized by the constant exchange of presence among its members. The exchange of presence strengthens the spiritual community. It's a natural expression of the life of the spiritual community. Not that you give to her because she gives to you. You all just naturally feel like giving to one another, so you express that feeling by the actual giving of gifts. She also brought chocolate, which I'm really looking forward to breaking into after this talk. I said, oh, for me? And she said, no, it's for the whole team. Okay, so then kindly speech. So as I said before, my way into this has been deep listening. So I found that when I listen deeply to my friends, I can perceive what is below or beneath what they're actually saying. I can intuit their deepest hopes and fears and their deepest potential for awakening. And then from this place, I can respond with kindness, help draw them out, reflect them back, talk about what it is that we're perceiving, encourage them, rejoice in them, delight in them. So we're drawing each other out, and we're drawing out the seeds of one another's enlightenment, helping those grow, hopefully. I'm going to be bringing Bhante in a lot in this last section, so another quote. He says, the Bodhisattva isn't afraid of giving expression to her affection for others verbally. She isn't afraid of letting other people know that she likes them. She isn't even afraid of telling them to their face that she likes them, just in case there's any doubt about it. Here, in this context, love is an expression of spiritual insight. We may say that the Bodhisattva's loving speech is the expression of her delighted awareness of people's spiritual potential, her delighted awareness of the fact that they can grow, that they can grow together. And I remember when I first came to Manchester and I was having a particularly rough time, I showed up at the Buddhist Center for a festival or something, I can't quite remember, and Vijayamala came up to me and she said, oh, Singhasri, I really, really like you. I really want to be your friend. Let's hang out. And that really meant a lot to me, actually. It was a really important moment, and she could see that I needed that. So I do try and say that now, especially to Mitras. I try and say, I like you. I want to be your friend. And they do seem quite surprised most of the time. But we could just do that, couldn't we? We don't have to hold back. Why would we hold back? And as I was saying before, we do these things with ourselves as well, so we can also practice listening deeply to ourselves. So what are the stories that we tell about ourselves and others? How do they condition the way we speak to ourselves and others? What effect does that have? What wrong views do these stories help maintain? And also, you know, what's happening? What can we listen deeply into ourselves in terms of our own seeds of enlightenment? So I think if we do spend that time exploring, we will touch into a deeper truth about ourselves that we can then share with others. So the practice of kindly speech helps to align us with the truth of conditionality. So when we see that ourselves and others are just the result of a complex set of conditions, we can more easily let go of fixing ourselves and others in our minds through our opinions and attitudes, which are not ultimately true, and unfortunately often get expressed through speech. So I don't know about you, but there's a very, very short space sometimes between an opinion forming in my mind and then it getting expressed through speech to whoever happens to be in my vicinity. And that can be quite painful, I think. Well, it can be painful to be on the receiving end, and it can also be painful when I realize what I'm doing. So we really do need to take on that what we say matters. So what we say is also a conditioning factor in our own and others' liberation. So we're conditioning each other all the time. We're having an effect on each other's mental states. So we have a great deal of responsibility to one another to speak in ways that support liberation rather than reinforcing suffering. So through our speech, through our dialogue with one another, we are reflecting to each other the efforts that we're making on the path. So we're mirroring each other back. We're drawing out the qualities that we appreciate. We're helping ourselves become more conscious of them and therefore more able to cultivate and sustain them. But we also do the opposite. So we also help each other to explore the ethical implications of our thoughts, words, and actions and name our unconscious habits and the conditions that give rise to them. And we help each other to confess and resolve to act differently. So that's, I think, where the risk comes in. So it can be, maybe it's easier to rejoice in each other than to help each other actually get under our unskillfulness. And I think chapters are really, really excellent place to do that. So I know we talk a lot about it being a spiritual workshop. I do want to actually take a moment to rejoice in my chapter. And I think something is happening right now, actually. I was telling Manisha this morning, it seems like one by one we're all falling apart, and I'm a bit worried about when that's going to be my turn. But it is lovely to witness and be a part of.
Your time will come.
We're just breaking each other down. It's great. Lovingly. So then, beneficial activity. So I suggested that before we can really sufficiently practice beneficial activity, which Bhante translates as the giving of the gift of the Dharma, I like to think of it as, in terms, especially in this context, just sharing our practice with each other. We need to practice receptivity. So not just receptivity to the teachings, but also receptivity to one another's practice, especially people who maybe their practice is expressed quite differently than ours. So just really trying to see, well, how does that work for them? What's happening for them? And appreciate that in its own right. And the aspect of reality that beneficial activity helps align us with is the truth of suffering. So I think when we can really see suffering, really see it in its all of its sort of manifestation, both subtle and gross, we will want to share the Dharma. We will want to share our practice, even beyond the movement. So just with anyone, in any way that's appropriate. So Bhante says, the Bodhisattva practices beneficial activity by giving people the Dharma, sharing with them her own experience of the Dharma, sharing with them, in a word, herself. She benefits them by sparking them off. She benefits them by communicating to them the emotional positivity, the excitement, the creativity, the sheer adventure, if you like, of the spiritual life. I love that, the sheer adventure of the spiritual life. Okay, so exemplification. So earlier we talked about this principle of spiritual development. In a way, I think of exemplification as just the culmination of the first three. So it's just sort of all wrapped up in exemplification. And for me, the ground is really around confession. So first touching in with our own sort of being able to be sensitive enough, have sort of work the muscle of our own ethical sensitivity in our own practice. For me, that's very much in meditation. And then bringing that into our consciousness and then saying it. So there's that process of, where's something quite not right? Where's something quite not in harmony? What's that about? And then it, through our spiritual friendships, just trying to bring that into consciousness more and more and voice it. And then through exemplification, we can align ourselves more with the truths of non-separateness and interconnectedness. So if we really knew we were connected, if we really knew that, we were not separate in any way, we would act wholly for the benefit of ourselves and others. So there'd be no difference in what we were doing in terms of who it benefits. We wouldn't treat others any differently than we would treat ourselves. And we would respond as creatively to others as we strive to respond to ourselves, and vice versa. Okay, so I'm going to stop talking soon. So I'm going to end with this quote from Bhante about how exemplification is not about being the perfect exemplar. So I pulled a bit from this quote earlier, but I'm going to give you the full quote, or as much or more of it. So Bhante says, in any case, our vision is not a vision of some fixed and finite goal. Our vision is more like a vision of constant progression, constant upward movement, constant transformation. It's more like a vision of ever-increasing creativity with no perceptible limit. So speaking about our vision really means speaking about that. When we exemplify our vision, this is what we really exemplify. Exemplification does not mean being the living embodiment of a particular point in the process of spiritual development, however high that point may be. It means being the embodiment of the principle of spiritual development itself, to however limited an extent, It means, surely, that we are at least making an effort to evolve. So, my helpers with this talk suggested that I summarize. I'm not very good at summarizing, so I'll give it a go. So I've said a bit about my own personal experience of getting in touch with spiritual friendship, the first spiritual friendship that I ever developed, which was with Viveka. And then I talked a bit more about this koan of spiritual friendship. So this koan of being basically just striving, really, to be with one another's messiness while also imagining each other as Buddhas. And that sort of like, that is unconditional love. And, yeah, I just sort of shared my own, what's alive for me right now in spiritual friendship, especially around how it's a means to insight. And then I shared a bit around the ground and the view of each Sangha or Vastu. So where we can start and what we ultimately wake up into, through practicing the Sangha or Vastus. And, I hardly ever give talks titles, so I didn't say anything about the title of this talk before I started, so I will just say now, this talk is entitled, We Are Not Broken, We Are Alive. And that's the last line of a poem called The Goose in the Bottle, which I can't remember who wrote that poem, but if you're interested, I can share it with you. And I've just taken the liberty of turning it into third person first person plural rather than first third person no sorry second person singular. So in the poem it's you are not broken, you are alive, but I've turned it into we are not broken, we are alive. So that kind of sums up the koan, doesn't it? We are not broken, we are alive. So questions we can ask ourselves. So we're going to have discussion groups in a minute. In a minute, Charnalka is actually going to very skillfully help us get into, she's got a whole scheme of how she's going to do this, get into discussion groups. So these are some of the things you could explore, but then you could just do whatever you want, really. So this is just a suggestion. So where can I begin with the Sangha of Vastus? So what is your personal ground, you could say? Which do you feel most in touch with? How can you be creative in how you go about practicing them? What's the starting place? So there's that question. What are the conditions that support us to show up for each other in spiritual friendship? To take risk with one another and to bring ourselves in more and more and draw one another out more and more? Do we actually believe that developing insight into the nature of reality can have a transformative effect on our friendships? And how can that happen? How are we making progress in that endeavor? So thinking about this principle of spiritual development, how have we seen that exemplified in others, and how do we exemplify that? So this thing about not exemplifying a particular point in our process, but just being the Dharma, just being the practices. Do we really believe that friendship is all of the spiritual life? How can friendship help lead to the awakening of all beings? How can the practice of the Sangha of Vastus liberate us?